And as a positivist, he believed that Indians were part of an socially or evolutionarily undeveloped society who eventually could reach the same level as Europeans, but it would take time. So he recommended a very paternalistic kind of treatment of Indians, and at the same time a very protective one. His scheme, which became the guiding philosophy of Indian policy in Brazil, can be summed up in the term quarantine. The idea was to separate Indians from the greater society long enough for them to evolve into full equals. But the policy of quarantine...
To evolve into Europeans?
To evolve into Europeans. The stated aim of Indian policy in Brazil, and this is true in many other Latin American countries, has always been assimilation, to allow Indians to gradually assimilate to the standards of conduct and behavior and culture of Euro-Brazilians in terms of language and virtually every other feature. And all of the negative stereotypes which attach to the indigenous ways of life, particularly to subsistence production, such as the idea that subsistence production is not work, and that natives don't work, and that they don't want to work, and that they don't produce, and that they don't produce anything for the future. They're not building anything. They're not interested in development. All of those stereotypes have been virtually sacrosanct. Even people... Very often people who defended the Indian cause subscribed to these same stereotypes. That was a very common pattern in the past, and it remains a pattern to this day. The Indian Protection Service, which was founded in 1911 by Rondon, which lasted until 1968, was, if anything, could be compared unfavorably to the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the United States. It's one of the most incredibly inefficient and corrupt services in the history of the country. So bad, in fact, that it was dissolved in 1968 after a series of scandals came to light and were exposed in the international press. Now, that's an interesting feature that I'll mention very briefly now, but I think it's very important, the fact that the international environment has had a significant impact on indigenous affairs in Brazil, and in other countries, in Africa, in Latin America, and to some extent in Southeast Asia, that the mistreatment and lack of official concern for indigenous minorities has been exposed in many instances in the international press, and in some cases there has been some corrective action taken. It's a very spotty record, but there definitely was a beneficial effect of the intense scrutiny of the Brazilian Indian policies during the late 60s and early 70s, which had generally beneficial effects. At any rate, the progress was very slow because the Indian Protection Service was replaced by the National Indian Foundation, or FUNAI, which has been commanded or led by military generals who have, in each case, have had absolutely no experience with indigenous affairs over the last 16 years of the existence of the agency. And in many cases, some of the same kinds of accusations of corruption, of mistreatment, and of malfeasance have been made against the FUNAI officers. Just to give you a few insights into the legal status of Indians in Brazil, the Indians are recognized in the Brazilian Constitution. They are recognized as separate peoples, although their sovereignty is not and has never been recognized as separate. Treaties were never made with Indian nations in Brazil. So that there is virtually no legal basis in that country for an indigenous claim to sovereignty, although in some cases that language is used in discussions between indigenous spokespersons and the government The government rejects them entirely. The Constitution guarantees to indigenous people the right to the land that they occupy and to the resources on that land. However, the Indian statute adopted in 1974 places the Indian rights into those resources in trust to the National Indian Foundation. The National Indian Foundation has set up as a foundation deliberately as the administrator of this trust. And as such, they feel that they have the right to manipulate and invest in these Indian lands, some of which are set aside as reservations, for the benefit of what they call the patrimonio indigena, or the Indian endowment. The interesting fact here is here that the proceeds from any investment and from any exploitation of resources on Indian lands do not go back necessarily to the particular reservation involved, but rather go into the Indian endowment and are available for the general revenues in the general revenues of the Indian Foundation. The record that FUNAI has had and the Indian Protection Service before it has in terms of protecting the habitat of in which indigenous peoples live is, I think, can truly be said to be abysmal. A lot of the corruption that took place involved illegal logging and taking of game and fish on lands that were presumably being administered for the benefit of Indians. The most recent factors which have driven events in the north, which is where the majority of the tribal indigenous populations live, have involved the large-scale development of the region, of the Amazon region, through penetration roads, through large-scale agricultural enterprises, and now what will certainly be the largest single iron ore mine in the world, the Carajás development in southern Pará State. And each of these developments has had enormous impacts directly on the indigenous peoples in the region and on the habitat. I won't even bother to go into what the particular kinds of habitat impacts have been, but where hundreds of thousands of hectares of land are being cleared at one time, you can imagine they are quite massive. The environmental protection in Brazil is a very weakly developed art, shall we say. There is an agency entrusted with environmental development, and there are guidelines, with environmental protection, and there are guidelines in codes concerning, for example, how much land in a given tract can be cleared. But they have been systematically ignored. And I read one estimate based on satellite photography, satellite imagery, recently that suggests that about 10% of the tropical forest of Amazonia has already been cleared, and that perhaps 25% will have been cleared by the end of the century. The impact of this on native subsistence regimes, as you can imagine, is absolutely devastating. By and large, there are a few species which are the taking of which is prohibited in Brazil. But aside from that, there are virtually no quotas, no allocations, no bag limits, no hunting seasons, no hunting licenses. Theoretically, in the entire country, Indians have the right to hunt on their own reservations, and non-natives do not have the right to hunt on Indian reservations. This is more honored in the breach than in the observation, although in some few cases, Indian groups have taken to policing their own reservation areas in order to prevent outsiders from hunting and fishing in those areas. And then as a last point on this subject, it's important to point out that the enforcement of the few environmental laws that exist on the books in Brazil is nil. There virtually is no enforcement. So that many of the kinds of conflicts that exist here are found, but in a very different form, because while there's relatively little legal interference with Indian subsistence activities in Brazil, there are innumerable kinds of illegal and extra-legal interference with their activities, as well as the massive habitat destruction, which I've already mentioned.
Would this, I thought we'd take a coffee break this morning, so if this is a convenient point at which to break off.
That's fine. What I'd really like to do would be to engage in discussion on any of these points, okay, if any of them has stimulated any interest.
Well, maybe in just a moment we could take a coffee break and then return and have any questions or observations about Dan Gross's point. And then before lunch, perhaps we could reach Joe Meeker and have him tell us what he, as a non-native and non-Alaskan and non-Northerner, at least now, has learned from all of this, and then we can carry on from there and tell him after lunch where we think he's gone wrong. I should say that it's appropriate that Dan Gross should be telling us about Brazil. I was advised some time ago that the Inter-American Human Rights Commission will be urged to recommend to the government of Brazil that a commission like the Review Commission be established to consider the rights of the Indian people of the Amazon. And no doubt the first thing they would wish us to do would be to reassemble this roundtable in Rio. But I urge you not to make your reservations yet. But if you want to invest in a Spanish dictionary, that's your business. So
Oh, you mean with this?
Yeah.
No, it's time.
Oh.
I thought you meant this, these numbers. Just a one going too long.
I thought you were adding up people were talking about
the words. No. I was adding. I spoke for about 30 minutes.
Well, did you want to add anything to what you had said, Dan?
There is one aspect that I think might be interesting to add, if you could bear with me for about 3 or 4 minutes. I conducted a study with several Brazilian and American researchers in 1975-76, where we tried to compare four different indigenous groups living in central Brazil who were still pursuing a substantially subsistence-oriented lifestyle. And one of the objectives of our research was to determine what the effect of environmental circumscription was. At one end of the scale, we had a group that was very isolated, that exploited an area that was the size of Belgium, virtually without any competitors, humans, that is, of any ethnicity, And at the other end of the scale, we had a couple of villages that were heavily circumscribed. They lived on reservations. They weren't permitted to hunt or farm off of those reservations. Their own populations were growing. And they were gradually degrading the environment within those reservations. So we tried to look at some of the features of their subsistence activities within these areas. And some of our findings might be of interest here. We found that in the groups which had been in one place for a longer time, and which were slowly degrading the habitat in which they lived, that the output per unit effort for all activities was much lower. That they had to work harder to farm, work harder to hunt, and work harder to get fish. This expressed in terms of the output in game, fish, and garden produce per hour worked. At the same time, that all of these groups maintained subsistence activities, ranging from, for example, the search for wild foods among the Mekranoti, which is a Kayapo group, which has been in contact for only 16 years at the time of the study. They spent an average of 450 hours a year per food producer searching for game and other wild foods, whereas at the other end of the scale, the group that was the most circumscribed was spending an average of 271 hours a year at similar kinds of pursuit. And in other words, they had reduced their investment in that particular part of their subsistence activities because it simply wasn't lucrative enough. They weren't getting enough game and fish and wild fruits and vegetables to compensate for them going into the forest looking for these things. At the same time, they increased their dedication to horticulture, so that when we look at the same figures for the amount of time spent in horticulture, gardening, we find that the group that was at the least circumscribed end of the scale was spending about 450 hours per year gardening, whereas the group that was most circumscribed was spending about 910 hours per year hunting. It's interesting that the total expenditure of time on subsistence activities did not vary nearly so much when we looked at all activities together. It ranged from about 900 to about 1,200 hours per year per food producer. So that what we found was that as one activity became less productive, another activity was emphasized. We also found that as we moved from the group that had the least contact and the least circumscribed environment, that the activities which were devoted to production for the market, either wage labor or production of handicrafts, rose considerably. It went from 158 hours per food producer in the least affected group to 542 hours in the most affected group, so that one of the ways in which they had compensated for the loss of subsistence was by increasing participation in the market economy. And the only additional observation I want to make is that you could not distinguish any of these groups from each other in terms of its devotion to a completely native lifestyle. There was no greater incidence conversion to Christian religion, for example, in any of the villages. There was no greater use of Western clothing. They all used indigenous clothing. While there was a much higher proportion of bilinguals in the group that was more circumscribed, none of the groups had abandoned its exclusive use within the village of its native language. And ceremonialism was strong in all of these villages. What I take this to mean is that while clearly the groups that were heavily circumscribed and found it necessary to limit and adapt their subsistence activities to the habitat conditions that they faced, that by responding creatively and adaptively, they were able to maintain their identity as an indigenous group, and that there was not a necessary destruction of their native culture as long as they could maintain at least some of these activities, and that there was a great deal of creative adaptation and the adoption of new items of technology and other activities, subsidiary activities, which in fact reinforced the maintenance of an indigenous pattern of life.
Well, thanks very much. That was very interesting. Would anyone like to ask any questions of Dan Gross about the comparisons he's made between third world subsistence and subsistence here in what we like to think of as the developed world, I mean Canada and the USA? I have one question. I gather that Brazil, and you gave special attention to Brazil, is moving from a military to a democratic form of government, and that there may well be a more sympathetic attitude toward the rights of the indigenous people. Does it make any difference whether it's a military regime or a democratic regime?
It does to an extent, but perhaps if I indicate some of the most recent developments that will help to answer that question. The Minister of the Interior, until he was eliminated recently, was a candidate for a nomination for a president. His ministry is responsible for the National Indian Foundation. Recently, a group of aggrieved Indians from the Xavante ethnicity made a visit to Brasilia, and they surrounded, for the second time in recent years, the National Indian Foundation wearing their native dress and with bows and arrows. And they demanded an audience with the president of the foundation and made a number of demands on him and revealed to the press a number of abuses that they had identified in the administration of the foundation. The ultimate result of this was that the president of the foundation was asked to resign, and for the first time a civilian president was put into place to replace him. So that was progress, and I think it had to do with the liberalization of the regime. And the fact that it's almost certain that the next president of Brazil will be a civilian, and one of the candidates happened to be this particular minister. On the other hand, the civilian the current minister,
yeah.
Andreasa is his name. The new president of FUNAI, a man named Jurandir Fonseca, remained in office for approximately 3 months, because while he was in office, the president signed a decree, which is a particular form of legislation peculiar to the Brazilian system. The president can rule by decree when Congress is out of session. And the decree declared that mining was to be permitted on Indian lands, mineral exploration and mining. And that special agreements would have to be formed between FUNAI and mining companies that wished to exploit mineral resources on indigenous lands. Jurandir Fonseca, the new president of FUNAI, refused to countersign the decree, and he was removed. Now the new president of FUNAI, after a three-month hiatus with a civilian president of FUNAI, the new president is a former police chief, also with no indigenous experience.
Well, Rosita Worrell.
I have two questions. The first one is from Marie, and she wants to know if the Brazilian natives have become Europeans yet.
not in the least. Those groups which have managed to maintain village life, where communities have not been devastated, so devastated by economic conditions and by the depredations, in some of which were quite severe, and particularly in the past, where they have managed to maintain village life. It would be safe to say that for those remaining 120,000 or more native peoples, that they do not show many signs of being Europeanized. And contrary to popular belief, many of these native populations in Brazil are now on the increase. They are rising in population, thanks in part to the beginnings of a provision of adequate medical care. But there still is a very, very high morbidity and mortality rate in all, virtually all native groups in Brazil. But culturally speaking, I would not say that they've become Europeanized to any great extent at all, so long as village life has been maintained.
The second question that I have relates to that interaction between the subsistence activities and then the larger market economy. And in the case of James Bay, we see that they have that income security program. I'm wondering how the natives down there acquire their necessary cash.
Through a variety of means. In most cases, they have attempted to acquire cash through their own activities, either as wage laborers off their reservations, even though they are technically prohibited from working off reservations. Virtually all Indians do so where they have an opportunity to. In some few cases, there have been provisions made for government pensions which are available to rural agricultural workers to be paid to some Indian areas. These would be for persons who are over 65. There is the sale of handicrafts, but that is very severely hampered by the insistence of FUNAI of being the sole marketing agent for these handicrafts, so that where they've attempted to control the commerce in Indian handicrafts. And there have been two consequences of that, one of which has been the relatively low productivity, and the other one is that very little attention has been paid to the maintenance of quality levels, so that the result is that most of the Indian artifacts which are marketed in Brazil now tend to be of a trinket nature. They're the lowest possible quality of workmanship, and they command very, very low prices in the shops where they're sold. So it's a controlled market with very, very negative results, I think, for the possibility of that becoming a resource.
You said they were technically prohibited from working off the reservation?
That is correct. In most cases, that under the philosophy of quarantine, outsiders are theoretically are not supposed to enter Indian reservations without written permission, although it happens frequently. And Indians are not supposed to leave their reservations without permission, although that happens frequently. But under this presumably helpful philosophy of quarantining Indians from contact from the greater society, they have prevented Indians from seeking wage labor. This has created a situation of dependence where Indians feel that the only way they can get certain kinds of resources, such as medications, steel tools, firearms, and ammunition, which they need, is to demand them from the National Indian Foundation. And it's created a very unfortunate situation of dependency and a situation in which visitors to Indian villages frequently are accosted and demanded that they make contributions or give gifts and so on. And what one of the results of this is it reinforces a popular opinion that Indians are beggars. But in fact, one of the reasons why this kind of dependency has been fostered is that the government prohibits Indians from engaging in activities with outsiders. Indians cannot legally sign any kind of contract in Brazil because they have the same rights as children. Under the Indian legislation, they are wards of the state, so that they can't enter into any kind of contract, including marriage contracts, with non-Indians without the explicit written permission of the National Indian Foundation.
Marie Adams.
in those reservations, do they allow Native people, other Native people, to enter into their reservations?
Only in the last 10 or 15 years has there been any movement at all towards the formation of a unified, I'm not sure I'm really answering your question directly, but I think that's where you're...
In the country.
Yeah, well, okay, narrowly speaking, no. Technically speaking, all access to Indian reservations, including access by other Indians, even if they are members of the same ethnicity, technically is prohibited. So that technically the idea is that they want to control that kind of access and exchange of ideas and contact, even between indigenous peoples. That has gone on against the wishes, in some cases against the explicit wishes of the National Indian Foundation, nevertheless, and with particular assistance from elements of the liberal clergy in the Catholic Church, who have formed a special missionary council which is oriented towards the liberation theology, and they have fostered a number of meetings between indigenous leaders, and the result has been now the formation of a national association of Indian nations. And that national association, although it's hampered by every possible kind of problem, including the lack of ability of many of these people to speak to each other, because many of them are monolingual and do not speak Portuguese, that group has begun to make itself heard in national affairs. That's partly a function also of the liberalization of the press laws that only recently was censorship lifted on the press. So the freedom of the press has actually assisted that development in Brazil.
Any other questions? Marie.
I'd like to make one further comment dealing with the International Whaling Commission. We deal with different countries with Aboriginal peoples, and one of the things that we've tried to do in dealing with those countries is to appeal to the governments that you have Aboriginal people. You know, can't you see some sympathy in dealing with our situation? I think it's, you know, for those of us who have to deal with international politics, it's important to understand these kinds of situations.
Thank you. Did you want to say something?
Is Brazil a whaling country? It is? Yeah.
The answer was yes. Well, thanks very much, Dan. And just before we call on Joe Meeker to open the last round of discussion, perhaps you'd allow me to remind you how far we have come. We began on Wednesday with a basic discussion of subsistence, and we've devoted the last 2.5 days to case studies of situations where Native people are taking initiatives in relation to their own subsistence way of life and management of the resources they depend on. And we heard from Tony Vasca about the Hooper Bay Bird Agreement. We heard from Marie Adams and Burton Rexford about the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, from Caleb Pangawi and others about the Eskimo Walrus Commission, from Jonathan Solomon and others about the International Porcupine Caribou Commission. We heard from Jim Kowalski about the measures being taken in under the Tanana chiefs in the interior. We heard from Willie Goodwin and Weaver Ivanoff about the initiatives being taken by IRAs, and we heard from Council for Yukon Indians. We heard about the Cope settlement, the proposals being made by the Dene Nation in Canada, and we heard from Harvey Fite about the Cree initiatives in the James Bay area, and from Dan Gross about the Third World, particularly Brazil. So having gone into these things in a fairly complete way. Perhaps we could spend the rest of our time talking in a more general way about what it all means and returning to the question that I posed at the outset, does subsistence have a future and what the necessary and sufficient conditions may be for assuring that future. So, Joe Meeker, we'll turn the floor to you and then we'll stop for lunch, I think, and then come back and go around the table and see what everybody has to say about you.
I hope not. Thank you very much, Tom. I think we really had a treat when Austin Hammond shared with us the blanket that included the stories that established his people's ownership of their land. And I felt envious at that time. I owned a couple of things, but I don't have anything nearly as interesting to prove what I own. I've at best got a couple of little slips of paper not even suitable for framing, let alone wearing at a ceremonial event. I also didn't have a grandfather who helped me learn how to live with the land or to understand the other creatures that I share the planet with. I was deprived in that sense. I only had an initiation beginning very late in life, in my early 20s, when I first came to Alaska and spent some years at McKinley Park. And that's where an initiation began for me into how to live well that I have pursued since then, and I'm still chipping away at it a little bit. I've learned a lot that helps me with that during the last few days. I'm very grateful for that. One of the things that it's made me realize is that the culture that I come from is in many ways quite an immature culture, and that it needs help if it's going to attain a higher stage of maturity. And we could use the help of the native peoples of Alaska and of subsistence people everywhere in doing that. We are doing some learning. Most of us in my culture no longer live in a place where there are any economic aspects to subsistence of the kind we've been talking about here for the last few days. We don't have a wildlife population. We cannot hunt. Most cannot even pick berries. But what we are doing is trying, and I think rather rapidly, now beginning to develop some of the cultural aspects of subsistence within my culture, and we do need help for that. It's coming in some unusual ways. Part of it is the result of the learning that has taken place over the last few decades as historians and anthropologists have studied subsistence cultures from the past and those that still persist in the present. We've begun to learn that those cultures which were previously thought to be primitive are actually extremely demanding upon the people within them, and that they require highly sophisticated, highly complex ways of thinking, responding, understanding, and acting. They are very highly developed from the point of view of social relationships, of mental attributes, of emotional life, of psychological balance, and of ecological understanding. Those are things that my culture needs more of and is now seeking. And we're seeking that in part from the study of subsistence cultures, past and present. We're also doing some other things. People in my culture are beginning to define something called bioregional life, where people are trying for the first time in decades to define the areas in which they live according to the biological characteristics of the region, watersheds, mountain ranges, valley systems, rather than according to the artificial political boundaries that have been imposed. And bioregional movement is afoot, very healthy and very widespread, not only in the United States, but in Europe and many other countries of the world as well. On another level, in our science, we are beginning for the first time to seriously understand the nature of very complex systems, ecological systems, and biological systems and physical systems. Some of this is coming through physics, through chemistry, and through ecology. All of those things are leading us to an understanding of integrated relationships of the kind that has been commonplace in subsistence cultures for thousands and perhaps millions of years. We're just beginning to scratch that surface that has been deeply plumbed by subsistence cultures for a long time. And again, we need help in doing that. Our institutions are changing. We are beginning to develop and recognize the value of consensus-based decision-making. And there are numbers of institutions, educational, business, and corporate institutions that are now experimenting successfully with the kind of consensus decision-making that has been dominant in village life for time immemorial. So these are forces that are at work in the culture that I live in that resemble some of the forces that are and have always been at work in the cultures of subsistence peoples. You can tell a lot about people by noticing what they read when they get up in the morning. If you read the sky and if you read the sea, you're reading an extremely complex newspaper, one that you can scan for signs of change, for trends, something that will tell you how to conduct your life during that day, how to live well during that day, if you know how to read the sky. Most people in subsistence cultures do know how to read the sky. If, on the other hand, you're from my culture and you wake up and instead you read the Wall Street Journal, looking for changes, trends, the clues and information that will help you to lead your day well and to come off well, that's another way of adapting. What I'd like to point out is that both of those things require the same highly developed mental and emotional skills. They are both subtle activities, and they are comparable in quality. If anything, I would say that knowing how to read the sky is a much more demanding and complex activity than knowing how to read the Wall Street Journal well. It takes longer to learn how to do it accurately and properly. And if I were to go out on the ice, I would certainly rather go with someone who knew how to read the sky than with, say, a PhD in meteorology or someone who knew how to read the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, what I'm trying to point out is that the same mental characteristics apply in both cases, and that they are high-level, sophisticated, very important kinds and qualities of mental life. The Arctic in general, and Alaska in particular, is a very wealthy place. It has enormous wealth. I think we have miscalculated the nature of that wealth. Certainly, it does not lie in oil. Oil is going to be a very small blip on the curve of world experience. It'll last 150 years at most, and it will be gone and will be inconsequential. The same is true of most of the other resources that are here. The minerals are not the important part of the wealth of Alaska. I think the significant wealth of Alaska lie in its lands and in the lifestyles that are here, in living forests, not in timber sales, in living animals, living in close reciprocal relationships to human beings. That, in the long run, is what the world needs to learn about. That is the wealth that Alaska needs to share with people who will need that knowledge and need that kind of understanding. That is the most significant long-term influence on the world that Alaska can have, and by comparison, oil and mineral resources are inconsequential. I would say, having listened to this last week's testimony and the vigor and intelligence and imagination that has gone into it, that subsistence is in good hands. It is threatened. But the other thing that seems to me unquestionably clear is that it is in the hands of people who are equal to the threats that are being made against it. I think all Alaskans, native and non-native, have a heavy responsibility to maintain and to enhance and to develop that subsistence way of life and the values that go with it for the world and for its future. I think it's important to, as I say, enhance the knowledge of how to live well in complex, demanding, and difficult places. Everybody is going to need that in the future, even more than we all need it now. Subsistence in its full dimensions is an extremely rare and precious treasure, and I hope you value it as the rest of the world does and will. The parts of it that are lost or damaged can't be replaced. It is an irreplaceable resource. The world needs a whole and a very healthy subsistence way of life to be kept intact, and as I say, we'll need it more in the future than we need it now. There, a dominant thing over the last 2 days particularly has been the focus on the economic aspects of subsistence. It may be that many of the native speakers that we have heard have to some extent adopted the Western view that subsistence is primarily an economic activity. I'm not sure of that. What surprised me is that some things that are extremely important to the future of maintaining a subsistence way of life were left out or were seen only in a minor way in our discussions. Some of these are significant threats that will have to be dealt with. We had a very brief discussion yesterday about military growth in Alaska. Many informed estimates are that over the next 15 years, the major economic activity in Alaska is going to be military, much larger than oil. There will be new military activities in response to Siberian military activities. And there could be very, very large impacts from the physical development and from the shifts in population and from the pressures on resources and wildlife and subsistence.